The Brad Sesnatt Show, broadcasting live.
Hey, welcome on into the Brad Sesnatt Show. I'm Jordan Spurgeon, filling in for the big guy today. Still taking care of some things at home, so hoping Brad and his family are doing well right now. But welcome on into the Brad Sesnatt Show. Once again, I am Jordan Spurgeon. We've got a lot to get to today. John Wilner will join me later in the show. So much to talk about, from potential tournament expansion to college football playoff expansion, the Brendan Sorsby situation, and what happened with his sports gambling, and so much more. So a really lengthy and insightful conversation with John Wilner coming up around the corner. And then Sam Valenti on our team. He has been doing great work here. He's been here about a year. You're starting to see him on air more and more and more. He's been doing a lot of things behind the scenes for us, like helping us edit segments for shows and things like that. But he has a really cool interview with Julie Ballard Clark that I wanted to highlight here. So that'll come up after John Wilner in this show today. As always, we're brought to you by Desert Financial Credit Union. Desert Financial, taking care of you, taking care of your business. As always, we appreciate their support. You know, we got to sit with them last week at a project that we're working on alongside them. And it's just always great seeing the people there, Jeff Mishi and the rest of the crew that we get to interact with. They are just some of the best people out there. They're in this for the right reasons. And I'm not going to talk much about it, but we're excited to bring you some really cool projects alongside them over the next year. So I'll leave it at that, but we really appreciate their support as always. Let's see, looking out over the weekend, not a ton of news locally. I think the big story, honestly, is the Arizona Diamondbacks. Last weekend, I was sitting here saying, hey, they're three games above 500, 15 and 12. They can kind of hover there for a while. Things will be all right. And I still stand by that. But now they're a game under 500, 16 and 17. They just got swept by the Cubs over the weekend. And they look awful right now. There is not a lot going on. You know, only really bright spot for them in the month of April is the fact that Ildemar Vargas was just named the April National League Player of the Month. That's a cool thing to see. His story is unique and interesting. He's been on this roster on and off many times throughout the years. Torrey and Mike Hazen have loved him as a utility guy, and it hasn't really fully worked out. And now he's been the best hitter on the team so far this season. But that tells you kind of what you need to know about this roster right now. The offense, which is supposed to carry this team, it's been a top five, top 10 offense the last three seasons, has not looked the part at all. Corbin Carroll's been up and down. Perdomo has not really gotten going. Ketel Marte's had his moments, but he hasn't really gotten hot yet. And Ildemar Vargas has been the best hitter on this team. Guys like Alec Thomas, Jorge Barrosa playing center field, they're both hitting below 200, and the defense has been pretty subpar. So the Diamondbacks are a tough watch right now, but it's May. You know, I saw a tweet, you know, this is kind of a yearly thing. It's, they're off to a slow start, but give them time. Then you get to May, and it's, they're struggling, but just wait till they get hot. And then you get to June, and it's, we've ripped off some wins, we're okay. Then you get to July, and it's like, if we could just win 15 of our next 20 games. Then you get to September, it's like, if we can win 20 of the final 25 games we're in. Might be heading towards that once again with the Arizona Diamondbacks this year. So there's still, you know, time for things to change with them. You know, you got pitchers coming back eventually, like AJ Puck and Corbin Burns and Justin Martinez. But if the ship starts sinking before then, things are going to change. Things are going to change fast. We've already seen multiple MLB teams make some managerial changes early in the season. The Boston Red Sox got rid of their entire staff last week. We saw some other changes as well across Major League Baseball. So not saying that's going to happen. That's not really the MO of Ken Kendrick. But if this thing really falls off the wheels, don't be surprised if there's a change at the top or within the dugout at some point. Not that I say that's the right move, but it wouldn't surprise me because Ken Kendrick wants to win. And I know this team hasn't been given all the tools necessary because of injuries, but you got to play better than you've played at this point. So the Arizona Diamondbacks, really what I'm watching for this month in May is to see whether or not they can finish the month above 500. If they can still stay in that, you know, two, three games above 500 mode, things will be all right. And I think there's a couple ways they can do that. I think the starting pitching that started off really hot through the first couple weeks of April has to get back on track. You've had multiple guys give up 5 to 6 runs an outing their last two outings in the rotation. You cannot win like that. Eduardo Rodriguez has been your best starter. He's going to have to continue to be that, but you're going to need Michael Soroka to get back to where he was early on. You're going to need Ryan Nelson to be what he was last year. You need Zach Gallen to be peak Zach Gallen. That might be gone by now. Merrill Kelly has been off to a terrible start lately, so they're going to need that to figure it out. The bullpen has actually been better than any of us expected heading into the season, so I think they're okay there. There's some ammunition in AAA. You know, I've been seeing Jack Summers over at SI and a couple other guys talk about it. There's a lot of bullpen arms in AAA that are pitching very well, including a Cade Stroud who came over in the Blaze Alexander trade. And so there are reinforcements on the way if any of these guys start to sort of regress from where they are right now. But as of now, the bullpen's been pitching great. It's the starting pitching and the offense that are the problem. And then on offense, what I'm proposing in May, I want to see some of the young guys get in. Alec Thomas, he has an option left. It's his last year. You can use it. I think he needs to go down to AAA. You know, he worked on his leg kick early in the offseason and through spring training. Things look good. It has not panned out. He seems to have lost a step in the outfield as well. So it may be time to bring him down and bring up your top prospect, Ryan Waldschmidt. I think he's ready. He's gotten a lot of bats in center field in AAA now. I know he hadn't played AAA before this year, so he's only gotten a little over a month in AAA. But at this point, if you're the Diamondbacks, you need something to get you going. When you brought up some other guys, it really did spark this offense. And so I do think doing that again might be something to kind of get things rolling. And if Alec Thomas can figure it out and he comes back and he's an important piece as a fourth outfielder later on when Jordan Lawler's healthy and all that, then great. If not, his time in Arizona is over and you have so many guys down in the minors and on the injured list that can take over. So what I want to see in May, I want to see them bring up some of the young guys, starting with Ryan Waldschmidt. That's what I want to see. I really think that can be the spark this team needs to just hang around. If they can hang around through the middle of June into early July, they'll be okay. If not, it's going to be a long summer. There'll be other things you can do with your time than go out to the ballpark. That's all I'll say there about the Arizona Diamondbacks. But that's really my rant for the day. Coming up next on the show, we'll have John Wilner, Wilner Hotline, diving deep into all things tournament expansion, playoff expansion, Brendan Sorsby and sports gambling, and so much more. That's all coming up after this quick timeout. As promised, joining me now, John Wilner, Wilner Hotline. You can find all of his content over on our website. And John, you know, we're here in May, and there is just so much in this ever-changing college sports landscape. I know it's been nonstop for a while, but specifically these last few weeks, there's just been a lot of things coming down the pipeline. So I guess where I want to start, I think the big one, because this could lead into so many different things in college sports, is the potential of expansion in the NCAA basketball tournament, moving potentially to 76 teams.
Yep.
Where are you standing? Where are you kind of hearing things where that stands right now?
That was last Tuesday, maybe, and it feels like 2 weeks ago. 3 weeks ago. You know, it used to be that this was the slow time. And now all the important stuff in college sports happens between like April 1st and August 1st. So the parallels between the playoff expansion and the tournament expansion are interesting. We can get into that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, NCAA tournament expanding, in theory expanding, expected to expand, you know, in the next month. I think it'll become official, but clearly the NCAA is comfortable enough with the likelihood that it's going to happen that they were willing to leak it to ESPN. They have to have it approved by the various levels of their bureaucracy. You know, they need to dot the I's, cross the T's on the media deal component with CBS and TNT and TBS. But yeah, we're going to have 76 starting next year for men and women. It will be the first major expansion of the tournament since, depending on whether you want to call the first four a major expansion in 2011, I think that was more of an incremental move. This is really the first major expansion since 1985, because I think going from 68 to 76, it'll change the tournament, the physical structure of the tournament, the brackets, and it's going to have potentially an impact on the regular season, which is a big deal. They're going to have, instead of the first four, it's going to be the first 12, really. They're going to call it the opening round, six games on Tuesday, six games on Wednesday. Those 24 teams will be a mix of 15 and 16 seeds playing each other, and then like the 10, 11, 12 seeds playing each other. You know, the mediocre teams from the big conferences that get the final at-large bids, there's now going to be a lot more of those, which I know we all wanted to see 16-loss Auburn and 15-loss Oklahoma get in the tournament. Now there's going to be a lot more of that.
Right. I think that's that's the interesting part about it, because in sports, you know, changes, I'm usually on board with all of them. I think most of them are great. You look at baseball having the pitch clock. You look at the way the NBA does the play-in games and college football, the way the playoff has expanded. It's all been great. But adding to 76, again, you're adding in more mediocre basketball teams. Yes. I don't know how many of those Bobby Hurley bubble team ASU teams really deserved that chance to get in there. And yeah, it's, yep, maybe it's great for the school, but it's really not a higher quality of basketball, right?
No, it's not. And none of those teams are capable that are going to make it. The new age are not going to they're not going to have a chance to win the national title. So that it certainly doesn't add to the competitive benefit. And there's no reason. If the first two teams left out in March were literally 15 loss Oklahoma and 16 loss Auburn, right? There's no competitive reason to include these teams. They can't do much. Now, if they were going to, if the 12 at-large teams that were going to play in the new opening round, if some of those teams were the third place team in, say, the new Pac-12 that's won 23, 24 games, or the second place team in the Missouri Valley that's won 25, you know, I wouldn't mind seeing those. I like the mid-majors and the non-power conference teams getting in, but that's not what we're going to see. Of these new eight spots, six or seven of them are going to be ACC, Big 12, Big 10, SEC. You know, teams that were 7-11 in the SEC are going to be in the tournament. And I don't think they need it. And we'll see the impact it has on the regular season. That's a TBD. It is different. Like the football expansion to 24 is, to me, I'm against it. But at least if you are expanding football a little bit, some teams that didn't get in this year, competitively, you can make a case they should be in. For instance, Notre Dame, which got left out, Notre Dame could have won the national title, right? They were really good. The basketball version of expansion is not like that. The teams that are going to get in are not really good. They're very, very mediocre.
Yeah. No, I think that's spot on. And, you know, I want to get into, you know, what you touched on there with football too, because I think the NCAA tournament and then this 2014 expansion of football, I almost think they kind of go hand in hand and sort of some of the things that are, yes, similar. Obviously, there's a lot that's different, but I know in recently one of your mailbags, you know, you kind of considered this like the Cold War right now, and it stems, mm-hmm, from the Big Ten and the SEC and the way that they need to navigate this, and the executives in different positions are the ones sort of holding things up right now. How do you sort of see this playing? I know you've already said you're against 24. I'm also against 24. I think we're in a great spot where we're at. Maybe 16, there could be an argument, but 24, that just kills bowl games, and that creates a whole new sport at that point.
Well, and it could have a huge impact on the regular season. No other sport, no other major sport, Jordan, would, after expanding to 12-team playoff, just 2 years later decide, let's go to 24. I mean, you know, the NFL wouldn't do it. The MLB, nobody would do this, but college football is so different and so leaderless. And yet the people are so desperate for cash, right? I mean, let's make no mistake. The expansion on both fronts, football and basketball, is rooted not in what the fans want. I don't see anybody saying, oh, please, the tournament sucks. We need to have 76 teams, right? If anything, they should go back to 64. That was perfect. But this is all rooted in the fact that the decision makers, conference commissioners, ADs, head coaches, they want more teams means more job security. It means performance bonuses. It means happier donors, you know, happier university presidents. It's all based on what makes the decision makers more comfortable in this current landscape, not what the events need competitively or what the fans are clamoring for. So it's all upside down in that regard. And let's face it. I mean, the cash fraud that's needed for NIL, needed for revenue sharing, is probably the prime driver of all those factors for expansion. It's probably the cash, but the schools have enough revenue. The problem is they have too many expenses. They spend in an undisciplined fashion. If you increase their revenue, all they're going to do is spend more, Jordan, right? It's not like they're going to say, all right, well, we're not going to increase our budget by a dime. No. If you give them, let's just pick a number, $5 million more dollars, they're going to spend $4.9 million, right? I mean, they're going to do that. So they can't claim poor. They need more revenue because that revenue is just going to be eaten up by increased expenses.
So I'm wondering then, I don't know how, without sort of a central leadership figure, and I'm sure you and Brad have talked about this before, how you fix this. And even then, picking the right central figure leader is hard because it could be somebody with a certain interest in ESPN or a certain interest from Fox or a certain interest in this conference or that conference. Right. And so it's very hard to actually pick someone who just wants to do it for the sport.
Nope.
But how do you really see this being fixed? Because it seems like at this point it's inevitable they're going to end up at 24 because of the greed, unless there is somebody that comes in and says, no, we're not.
Well, I think it is inevitable. The only question is whether they use a 16 team playoff as a little bit of a bridge. I mean, the bottom line is going to 24 is logistically difficult because there's that would eliminate the conference championship games, and those are under contract. So they need to unwind the contracts. They need to completely they need to go to market with the media rights. There'll be 12 new games, and ESPN, which has the currently has the contract, ESPN doesn't want 12 more games. They don't have any place to fit them in the middle of December. So they go to the bid. It would take a couple of years to get 24 implemented, even if they agreed to do it tomorrow. So where does it stand? It's basically the Cold War reference I made. Yeah, that it's like the Big Ten and its network partner Fox on one side of the table and the SEC and its network partner ESPN on the other side of the table. Right? ESPN doesn't want expansion. Fox does want expansion because that would give Fox an entry point to broadcast some of the playoff games. If there's 12 new games, there's some inventory for Fox that doesn't currently exist. So it's basically this standoff, ESPN SEC versus Fox Big Ten. And I don't know where it's going to end because both entities are doing what is serving their self-interest and not what is for the betterment of the sport. You can't get to that place. They're never going to appoint a czar because as soon as you appoint a czar of college football, the SEC and the Big Ten automatically lose the level of influence that they have now. So I don't know. They'll agree to 24 eventually. The SEC and ESPN will give in as long as there's some concessions made. But in terms of the overall direction of college football and its leaderless nature, I don't see how that ends. If anything, the SEC and Big Ten are consolidating their power and planning right now for what's going to happen in the mid-2030s and how they are going to have even more ownership of the sport, maybe even break away and form their own club. That is already probably in the works.
Yeah. No, that's good stuff there. John Wilner here with me for a few minutes. You know, I think another big topic that came up in the past few days, past week here, is the Brendan Sorsby story and just seeing the impact that has on a team like Texas Tech. And
It's
something that we're going to continue to see more and more of. There's a lot of unverified sources. You hear names being thrown around. Of course, we're not getting into all that at this point. But when you look at a situation like Sorsby, who bet on his own team when he wasn't playing allegedly, and allegedly placed bets at baseball games and all these different things, something that, you know, regular college kids are doing in today's landscape, but obviously as an athlete, you can't do those things.
Yeah.
What's sort of the impact that you're seeing here, you know, starting maybe with Texas Tech?
Well, I mean, the impact on the field is potentially significant, right? I think the NCAA will verify that he bet on Indiana while he was a redshirt in Indiana, and that you can't do. You can't bet on your own team. So to me, he has played his last game in college football. Now, Texas Tech has got a good backup. Will Hammond is the kid who came in and won the Utah game last September. He's recovering from a knee injury. So clearly Texas Tech can't be considered the favorite that they were. So that opens the door for BYU. It opens the door for ASU and for Arizona, Houston, a whole bunch of teams, you know, in the Big 12 race now have a better chance to win the conference championship. The off the field impact of the Swartzby situation and gambling itself, I think we're just at the tip here. You know, as long as I can get on this thing and place a bet within 30 seconds as to whether Brad Sesmat's going to have a hamburger for dinner, there's no stopping the impact, adverse impact that legalized gambling is going to have on college sports, right? I mean, we've seen issues. Iowa and Iowa State had issues a couple of years ago. The NFL's had issues, right? But it's just going to get worse as this thing becomes more prevalent. And, you know, at some point, California is going to legalize sports gambling. And then, you know, Katie bar the door. But the NCAA has got to do its best to get out ahead of this with Swartzby. They're going to try to send a message. Schools all over the country. I mean, I guarantee you Dillingham and Brent Brennan, what is it? We're recording. It's 9:30 Monday. You know, Dillingham and Brent Brennan have already had multiple discussions with their players since the Swartzby news broke about the gambling thing. And they're going to continue. And Swartzby's name is going to be splattered like on every locker in every college football program in the country, right? Don't do this. But that's tough. That is very difficult. It's much, much easier said than done. So to me, the question is, when is the next quote unquote scandal? And, you know, at least the Swartzby case, there's no link to, you know, a bigger plot to undermine the integrity of the game. This was one kid who's got a gambling addiction. Unfortunately for him, it's an illness, but at least we don't seem to have like the NBA scandal, right? So that's the one, you know, positive piece for the NCAA here is that it doesn't appear to be widespread. It was contained to one kid with an illness.
Yeah. No, and that's where you just hope that he gets the help he needs. Checking into rehab, that's a great, you know, move for himself. Personally, of course, obviously legally trying to finagle it. Like I said, it doesn't seem like that's
well, and part of the reason he's doing this, part of the reason he's doing this is if his NCAA career is over, he may try to get in the supplemental draft, which I think is in July. You know, and so he's got to do everything he can to convince NFL teams to take a chance on him. Because the thing is, he's good, right? He is an absolute legit day one, day two NFL quarterback, draftable quarterback. So he's got a lot at stake for his entire career, not just his Texas Tech career.
Yeah. And I think that leads into my last thing too here, because with that, you know, reportedly Texas Tech was finding ways to get him around $5 to $6 million. Now, obviously, this changes things. Who knows what the contracts were like, things like that. But this is going to be something that teams now have to take in as an extra precaution before going into the portal with these guys.
Sure. Because
especially the quarterback position, the offensive line position, certain skill positions. I mean, there's a lot of money involved. And, you know, I'm sure some booster paying somebody $6 million and then finding out you can't even step foot on campus after spring ball, that's not going to sit well, even with the school tech that has unlimited resources. So
that's a great point. Like
something that's going to change even how the portal and NIL works a little bit.
That's a great point. And, you know, the NFL does a great job investigating these. I mean, they know, you know, who everybody they've called for the last however many years with the security and private guest investigators using the NFL. We could start to see colleges do more of that for sure. But yeah, I mean, the donors who are supporting these rosters can't be happy. And the other piece of it is, you know, what legal recourse does Texas Tech have to recoup? I've heard they gave Swartzby about $4 million, which would make sense based on what the market was this winter. So can they recoup that $4 million if he can't play, if he's violated rules? You'd think that that was part of the contracts. He has also been sued by Cincinnati for to try to get back, claw back some of the NIL money. We'll see where this all leads, but I think we could see more exacting contracts. We could see more background work. You know, there's the more professionalized it gets, the more the colleges are going to have to make sure that their investments are sound.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, John, thank you so much. I appreciate the time. As always, it was a really cool discussion. And we'll catch up again soon.
Thanks very much, Jordan.
Yep, we'll be back after this timeout.
Hi, I'm Sam Valenti with Sports 360 AZ, and joining me now is new Arizona Gymnastics Assistant Coach Julie Ballard Clark. Julie, it is such an honor to be talking with you right now. And to start things off, what has it been like being on campus so far and just enjoying Tucson?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited. I don't know if you can tell, I'm grinning from ear to ear. And ever since I stepped foot on campus 2 weeks ago for my interview, I just felt like it was a place I could call home. So it has been amazing, from the weather to the scenery to the campus. Just it's beautiful out here. So I love that aspect. And I knew that I would probably love it because, knowing John and knowing the program and watching it over the years, I've always had a respect and a love for the program. And so just to be here in this particular role, in this position, and to see it firsthand has just truly made a difference in how I see it, and even more. Just being a part of it is now even more exciting to know that I can be a part of this journey and this program.
What excites you the most about being a part of the Arizona Gymnastics program?
You know, what excites me the most is getting back into this program, or not this program, but getting back into this age group. But most importantly, getting back, coming to Arizona and knowing that the foundation has been built on such a great work ethic, character, integrity, and knowing that there's been lots of success, but that they have just kind of come short of reaching that full potential of getting to nationals. And to be a part of this program speaks volumes of, hey, I get to come be a part of something that has a great foundation, has a wonderful support system, administratively, resources, but now has a lot of fire in these girls, and they have a lot of fire and grit. And the experience that I've had in the championship programs that I've been a part of, I am excited to bring that to the table so we can, as a full coaching staff, collaborate on, hey, where are the things that we are needing to focus more on to get us to this next level? And what else can we do to make to help these athletes reach their potential? Because I just feel like that's where John has mentioned to me. He said, you know, we need someone who can come in with a little bit more experience than what we've had. Someone who has gotten their fan base to 10,000 people. Someone who has experienced championships. Someone who's been under that pressure. Someone who has experienced it as an athlete and as a coach. And so for me to first of all feel the value of, or him seeing that value in me and saying, hey, I think you'd be a great fit for us, gives me so much joy. And I'm just in a state of gratitude and thankful that I can come in and we can work together on helping each other grow and helping each other reach our potential along with these girls and this team.
Now, of course, you attended the University of Georgia, and you were a member of the undefeated 1998 Gym Dogs team that won the national championship. Absolutely iconic stuff. What memories stand out to you the most from that season?
That was the best year ever and the best time in my life. And so what I remember the most is in the beginning of that year, Kim Arnold, myself, you know, we were roommates, teammates, and we decided as seniors that we want to do whatever it took, whatever it takes. And we wanted to come in that senior year with a whole different chemistry of our team. We wanted to come in and we wanted to be one. We wanted to lead by example. We wanted everybody to come together and let's figure this thing out, because we've had such great potential and we weren't hitting the mark. So that year, the biggest thing in the beginning, which I feel like was the foundation of what got us on that path, was we had hired a sports psychologist, and Stan and our coaches were very open and willing to see what were missing pieces that might have been small, but they made a big impact. And so breaking it down and taking the time to meet with us as individuals, the coaches would meet with us weekly, individually. So it took a lot more time. It took a lot more intention. And that was something that was so impactful, because come season, there was nothing that was going to break us. There was nothing that was going to break the confidence. It was nothing that was going to break us, because we would meet as a team once a week. We would meet as coaches and athletes together. And then we would meet, maybe it was just Kim and I as seniors meeting with our coaching staff. So the communication from the day that, I mean, from the beginning of 1997 fall into 1998, it truly marked the beginning of the intention of what we set out for, and didn't realize how much that was going to impact the outcome. So that was a huge part of it. The second most memorable thing is that when we were going to compete, and Karen Litchie was going to vault, and we had already won it, but she ended up going and I think got a 10 that last vault, but we didn't even need it. And it was just the fact that we continued to raise the bar and have each other's back. And if I was having a hard time, it didn't matter that someone else got put in, because we knew that, hey, you got my back. And we wanted the team to win a championship so bad. Nobody was in it for themselves individually. So it was just a really, really iconic year, undefeated, but kept building our confidence. But I think what I learned the most from it was the fact that you have to be intentional, and you have to be willing to grow and think outside the box and look at your teammates, your coaches, and everybody in a different way. And we all had to find a way to respect each other for our differences. And that has impacted me the most in my coaching career, whether it was club or if it was in college. And so I think that was just kind of the foundation.